The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Chapter 23 of Lands of the Andes and the Desert by Frank G. Carpenter. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Sunday in La Paz. Let us go this morning for a stroll about La Paz to see how the Bolivians spend the Sabbath. During the week, the city has a population of perhaps 100,000. On Sunday, this number is increased by thousands of Aymara Indians from the surrounding country. Whole families come en masse, many traveling 40 or 50 miles or more. They choose Sunday as their one and only trading day of the week, selling the products they have carried in on their backs and making all their purchases at that time. A visit to the market will show us the real La Paz better than anything else we could do. We leave our hotel on the plaza in the center of the city and walk past the police station and down the hill to Market Street. The sidewalks are filled with buyers and sellers, and we pick our way in and out among this mass of humanity for 3 blocks before we reach a living cross of all the hues of the rainbow. The Plaza San Francisco and the intersecting streets are filled with people moving to and fro, the whole making a kaleidoscopic picture such as can be seen nowhere else on earth. I have visited most of the great marketplaces of the world. I have haggled over prices in Calcutta, Bombay, and Benares. I have dickered with the Orientals in Cairo and Tunis, and with the Slavs at the great fair of Nizhny Novgorod on the Volga. I have seen the open-air markets of Africa and the mighty bazaars of Siam and Burma. But nowhere have I found so much color and brightness as right here in La Paz. It dazzles the eyes with a dozen different hues to Cairo's one, and the costumes of Calcutta would seem plain and dull beside those we see here. The Indians are dressed in the gayest of red, yellow, purple, and green. Grown-ups and children have practically the same costume, and even the babies are clad like their parents. The men and boys wear ponchos, embroidered vests, and pantaloons that reach halfway down the calf and are slit up to the knees at the back. A piece of white cotton is sewed inside the trouser legs so that they may be more easily rolled up when the Indian crosses a stream. Many of the men are barefooted, and some wear leather sandals tied on with strings. Practically all of them have on little felt hats with round crowns, under which are knit caps with earlaps. It is said that the Aymara wears his cap day and night throughout winter and summer, taking it off only when it falls to pieces. The Indian women wear hats like the men's, and their petticoats rival in gaudiness the ponchos and blankets we see. While most of the clothing of the Indians is made of wool that has been spun and woven by the women and children, much of the material for making ponchos has come from Germany in recent years. Trade agents from that country make a careful study of the wants of the natives, and the manufactured goods, made with the knowledge of the Aymara's love for bright colors, find a ready market. What a lot of babies there are all about us. We have to pick our way carefully to keep from stepping on them. Some lie on the bare cobblestones and play with the merchandise their mothers are selling. Others, too young to crawl, are tied up in shawls on the backs of the women, who go on with their business with apparent disregard of their burdens. There is one peeping out of that red shawl below us. Its face is as brown as a berry, and its little black eyes blink at us from under its yellow knitted cap, the earlaps of which stick out like horns on each side of its face. Another baby, a few months older, is being watched by its father, and on the opposite side of the street we see several taking their lunch at their mother's breasts. Most of the babies are laughing, and only one or two are crying. Some are pretty, some are ugly, and nearly all are dirty and covered with vermin. We see several whose heads are undergoing an inspection at the hands of the mothers who eat the product of their search. This condition is not confined to the heads of babies. It is found among both the Indians and the lower class cholos of all ages. Men, women, and children take part in both the hunt and the feast, the rule being that the hunter is entitled to all the game that he catches, no matter upon whose preserves he is pursuing the chase. In this connection, I might tell how I carried my poor Spanish with me from store to store in search of a fine-toothed comb, but the experience is too recent and too painful to relate. Mingled with the crowd is a large part of the white population of the Bolivian capital, which has come out to buy and see the sights. We pass women in black with black crepe shawls wound tightly about their olive-skinned faces. Formerly, no Bolivian lady of social standing would think of appearing in the market, but that condition is changing, and we see many women dressed in Paris models, who have evidently stopped at the markets on their way home from church. Some are accompanied by men who wear high black hats, black clothes, and black gloves. But let us get on with our walk. How quiet it is! There is the hum of conversation, and now and then the jangle of bargaining, but though there are thousands here, we hear scarcely a footfall. The bare feet and the leather sandals of the Indians make hardly a sound as their owners pass over the streets. In addition to the crowd on the cobblestone roadways are two long lines of women merchants sitting on the sidewalks with their vegetables and other products spread out before them. Here is a woman with a little pile of potatoes and two or three artichokes. Close by is another selling onions, and a little farther over a girl has for sale green roasting ears, peas, and lettuce. On the opposite side of the street is a woman who has flour in bags that hold but half a pint, and farther on are peddlers of fruit. As in the markets of Peru, everything is sold by the pile, and the piles are exceedingly small. There are no weights and measures to tell the buyer how much he is getting. A half dozen little potatoes, a handful of flour, or a tablespoonful of salt are the usual amount sold, and one person's entire purchases for the day could be crowded into a half-peck basket. Nevertheless, the variety of vegetables and fruits and meats is large, and the quality is especially fine. Bolivia has maize with kernels twice as large as any grown by our farmers. Some, of a bright yellow color, are as big as my thumbnail. Others are white and so floury that they can be mashed to a powder between two stones. Some of the corn is a mulberry color, other kinds are red or even jet black. In addition to the red, white, and pink potatoes we have already seen in Peru, Bolivia has a number of other varieties. Some, of a grayish-yellow color, will grow on the highest plateaus. They have an acid taste and must be laid out in the sunshine a while before cooking. Others are shaped like dahlia roots and taste somewhat like turnips. Nearly every potato seller has chuño among her wares. It is made in much the same way as that I saw in Peru. Along the Desaguadero River, one may see sacks of these potatoes, anchored by long strings to stakes driven into the bank, soaking in the stream before being frozen. The passage of a steamer near one of these submerged sacks is always the signal for an Indian boy to scamper down the bank to stand guard and see that the chuño is not washed away by the waves or broken loose by being caught in the paddle wheels of the boat. Strolling onward, we see quinoa, wheat, barley, and oats, all sold in almost infinitesimal quantities. Next are oranges, apricots, and bananas, sweet and sour lemons, and enormous white grapes. There are alligator pears twice the size of those that are sold in our markets, as well as tunas, the fruit of the cactus. One strange variety of fruit, the shirimoya, looks like a mammoth bean pod. It has a green skin and pulp that, when cold, tastes like finely flavored ice cream. One woman is selling coffee beans fresh from the grove, and another is peddling sections of sugar cane half as long as my arm. Most of these products have been brought by the Indians all the way from the Yungas Valleys. Among the Indians are many cholos. The women are known as cholas, and cholita is a semi-affectionate term for a young girl. The cholo men dress much as we do, but the women and girls cling to the same costumes of generations ago. They delight in bright colors and seem to have robbed the gorgeous Andean sunsets for the gay hues of their shawls and dresses. Hundreds of them wear skirts of sea green or sky blue, and not a few have short dresses of flaming red. They have shawls of the finest of silk. so draped that they stand out over the skirts. The skirts reach only to the calf of the leg, the plumpness of which is emphasized by high-buttoned shoes of white, cream, or blue kid. This fashionable footgear has high heels and is tied at the top by a cord and tassel. The girls wear straw hats that the Americans have most appropriately dubbed white enameled derbies. These have tiny black bands around the crown and bows on one side. Sometimes the bands seem to be pasted on the hat, and sometimes they are merely streaks of black paint. As the Cholita struts along the street on her high heels, she wears her hat rakishly tilted forward and walks with a swing. She flirts her skirts to show her green or blue stockings, but often she has no stockings at all, and what looks like hose of rose-colored silk is really an expanse of bare leg. The Cholas are very proud of their admixture of white blood. They consider themselves superior to their Indian sisters and look down upon the woman who wears a blanket or sandals. They are more intelligent than the Indians. Many of them own small stores and saloons and carry on much of the retail business of the Bolivian capital. Not a few are the sole support of their families, their husbands often doing nothing but loaf about the streets of La Paz, spending the pin money allowed them by their wives. Leaving the market and strolling onward, we are jostled by donkey and llama trains, and by Indians as well. Much of the freight of Bolivia is carried on the backs of the natives. When I arrived here, my trunks were taken from the depot by Indian cargadores, or porters, who charged me about 50 cents each for carrying 200 pounds a distance of more than a mile. I saw an odd load yesterday. It was a limp bundle about 5.5 feet long and perhaps 18 inches wide, rolled up in a blanket and thrown over a mule so that the ends hung down on each side of the animal's back. Beside it, on another mule, rode a policeman, while a crowd of Indian women came wailing behind. The bundle was the body of a woman who had been murdered a few days before for the $50 that she was known to have saved, and the policeman was bringing the corpse and the criminals to La Paz. Here comes a drove of llamas down a side street. Their heads are in the air, and their ears stand up like those of a fox terrier. They look this way and that, and seem surprised at the strange things about them. Every animal is marked or branded in a way that seems partly for identification and partly for ornamentation. Some are splotched with red paint, others have notches or holes cut into their ears, and many have their ears tied with gay ribbons and strings. Each llama has a bag of freight tied on its back with ropes that pass under its belly. They are loaded with taquia, or dried llama manure, which by nightfall will be distributed among the kitchens of the city as fuel. Practically all the cooking of La Paz is done with this fuel. Most of the coal used in the city has to be shipped in from other countries. Coal is known to exist on the Copacabana Peninsula in Lake Titicaca, along the route of the railway to Arica, and in other parts of the country, but none of the Bolivian deposits has been developed to any extent. Near La Paz, peat beds that cover 2,500 acres are being worked on a small scale. The freight rates on coal are so high that it is too expensive for ordinary use, and the result is that there is not a furnace or hot water heating plant in the whole city. Several of the wealthy families use electricity for heating purposes, and by paying an extra charge, I can have an electric heater in my hotel room until 10 o'clock at night. During the winter months of June, July, and August, the temperature in La Paz often varies 50 or 60 degrees during 24 hours. And although one may be comfortable at noonday in the bright sunshine, after nightfall many of the houses are decidedly chilly. The first stove ever used in La Paz was brought here about 30 years ago by the American minister to Bolivia, and was at first regarded with awe and superstition by the Indians. Even most of the whites at that time considered artificial heat injurious, putting it in a class with moonlight, which was to be avoided by all means. A journey begun on a moonlit night was certain to end in misfortune, while not even the most infatuated suitor, it is said, would think of serenading his chosen one beneath a full moon. The moonlight, he firmly believed, would bring on neuralgia if it struck his face and would cause baldness if his uncovered head was exposed to it. Llama manure is burned in small stoves, giving forth but little smoke and no sparks, and can be safely used by even the most stupid Indian. La Paz seldom has fires that do any great damage, and indeed I am told that only a few buildings have been burned down within the past 50 years. Most of the structures are built of mud bricks with trimmings of stone, and it would be difficult to set them on fire. Thatched roofs have been forbidden by a city fire protection ordinance. I can see great changes in La Paz since my last visit here. The capital has sprung into new life, and it seems to me more enterprising than Lima, although the latter is almost twice as large. New buildings are going up, and masons and carpenters are working everywhere. The streets are full of traffic. When I was here before, there was not a public cab in the whole city, and you could number the private carriages on your fingers and toes. Now there are taxis and innumerable private automobiles. There's also an electric car line that extends for about 2 miles down the valley to the suburb of Obrajes. The streets are so narrow that the cars often have to run at one side, and the trolley wire is attached to the walls of the houses. La Paz is a city of hills and valleys. The thoroughfares parallel with the river are more or less level, but the cross streets climb up and down, and the altitude is so great that one unaccustomed to it can walk but a very few steps without stopping to get his breath. Fat people especially are most uncomfortable, and are wise to avoid exertion as much as possible. I have been told here that cats cannot stand the rarity of the atmosphere of La Paz, as they go into convulsions and die. I was ready to accept this statement as true, particularly as I could not remember ever having seen a cat here, or of having my midnight slumbers disturbed by feline yowlings. When I mentioned this fact one day to an American who has lived in Bolivia for several years, he agreed that La Paz was seemingly catless, but attributed the condition not to the atmosphere, but to the natives' taste for stewed cat as a table delicacy. The use of automobiles in La Paz has brought a demand for better highways, and the rough cobbles of the more level streets have been covered with crushed stone. On the steep thoroughfares, however, the cobblestones afford a foothold for the llamas and donkeys, as well as for the human beasts of burden we see. Within the past 2 decades, La Paz has practically doubled in size. It has spread out to the edge of its basin and has begun to extend down the valley. In the center of the city is the beautiful Plaza Murillo, filled with shrubs, flowers, and trees. It was named for the Bolivian patriot who was executed there by the Spanish in 1810. On one side of this plaza is the capitol, and on another side is the executive mansion, where I called upon the president. It is a handsome building, beautifully finished inside. I went up a staircase of the purest white marble from the quarries of the Desaguadero River, and the magnificent parlor in which I was received was decorated with statues and paintings. Next to the president's palace is the unfinished La Paz Cathedral, which is planned to seat 12,000 people. It has been in the course of construction since the foundations were laid in 1843. Parts of it having been torn down and rebuilt again and again. Skilled craftsmen were brought from Europe to instruct the Indian workmen in cutting and polishing the stone used in the building, the natives proving surprisingly apt pupils. The altar is to be of native marble from the quarries not far from La Paz. The cathedral is being put up by funds obtained from a tax upon all the goods brought across Lake Titicaca, which is to be enforced as long as the work of building goes on. There are some unkind skeptics who allege that the cathedral will never be completed, as the contractors are desirous of continuing the receipts from these imports. Although some of the older stores of La Paz are not unlike those I saw in Cuzco, there are large business buildings that would be a credit to any city of the same size in the United States. Many of the stores that formerly were mere caves in the walls have put in plate glass windows and are displaying modern merchandise. As the plateau is chiefly a mining region and manufacturing is but little developed, most of the necessities of life must be imported, and consequently prices are high. I saw athletic goods for sale and learned that there are golf links on the heights above La Paz. There are several tennis courts in the city, and the first baseball game in Bolivia was played here on July 4, 1920. Between two teams recruited from the American colony. Homes of modern type are beginning to make their appearance in La Paz, and bathrooms and up-to-date plumbing are no longer the rarity they were a few years ago. On the outskirts of the city are many fine residences, some of them of the French villa and Swiss chalet type. They are of two stories with very high ceilings and are made of brick covered with bright colored stucco. Other residences are of Spanish architecture, surrounding patios in which are fountains and trees and beautiful flowers. Such buildings are found in the heart of the city, and from the streets the passerby can look in through the front doors and catch a glimpse of the gardens within. In some houses, the patios are used as storehouses and stables for the donkeys and the llamas that bring in the crops from the country estates of their owners. Many of the business buildings were once residences, and their patios are now filled with packing boxes. One thing that adds to the brightness of the Bolivian capital is a law that requires every man to paint his house front at least once a year. The annual painting season was not long ago, and just now everything is spick and span with gay colors. Another city provision is that everyone must each day sweep the streets in front of his house. End of chapter 23. Chapter 24 of Lands of the Andes and the Desert by Frank G. Carpenter. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. The First City in America. On the high plateau of Bolivia, not far from La Paz, are the remains of a prehistoric city that scientists say is probably the oldest in all America. It antedates Machu Picchu in Peru by thousands of years, its origin having been long forgotten when the Inca Empire was founded. The time of its building has never exactly been fixed, but the pottery, relics of gold and copper, and the skeletons of human beings taken from its ruins lead to the supposition that it was in existence 2,000 years or more before the first stones of the pyramids were laid down in Egypt. This ancient city is known as Tiahuanaco, and the ruins are only a half mile from the Indian village of that name. They are 12 miles from Lake Titicaca, but the remains of stone piers indicate that when the city was built, it was directly on the shores of the lake. Most authorities say that the ruins are those of a mighty city, but others claim that Tiahuanaco was merely a place of worship and a sanctuary. It is true that at its present elevation, this region is too cold and bleak to support a large population. That fact has led to the general belief that in the far distant ages, when Tiahuanaco was built, this part of the plateau had a much lower altitude and consequently a warmer climate. I stopped at Tiahuanaco on my way across the plateau from Guaqui to La Paz. As at most of these plateau towns, I was besieged at the station by Indians and cholas selling eggs, meat, and food, as well as by a horde of children and grown-ups offering me souvenirs. Knowing that visitors to Tiahuanaco are interested in the ruins chiefly because of their great age, the natives try to sell tourists ordinary pebbles and bits of stone, in fact, any kind of article they can find, blandly stating that they are antiques, thousands of years old. The village consists of mud huts, many with doorways of beautifully carved stone that has been brought from the ruins and set into the walls. On some of the thatched roofs are wooden crosses, which, with the Indians, have taken the place of the sun god symbol. The town has a Catholic church built partly of beautifully cut stones taken from the ruins of the ancient city. In front of it is a cross on a pedestal made of such stones, and on each side of the gateway that leads into the church are carved idols. These also came from old Tiahuanaco, whose people worshipped we know not what. The ruins are scattered over a broad level plain with an area equal to about a dozen 160-acre farms. There is nothing to be seen on any side except the mud huts of the Indians and the alpacas, llamas, and sheep shepherded by Aymara women who spin or knit as they watch their flocks. Between the fallen pillars and blocks of stone, a few scrawny pigs run grunting and squealing. In the distance towers the high wall of the Andes. Most of the ruins of Tiahuanaco have been carried away. Only the mighty pillars scattered here and there, the carved stones from the old buildings, and the remains of massive walls and terraced mounds indicate the wonders of the past. Some stones are half buried, and others rise above the tufts of grass and the scanty shrubbery. Traces can be seen of the five great structures which scientists know as the fortress, the temple, the palace, the hall of justice, and the sanctuary. The temple was a rectangle 455 feet long and 388 feet wide. Its outlines are marked by massive blocks of red sandstone, some of which are still erect. They evidently formed part of a rough wall that supported a platform of earth rising 8 feet above the surrounding plain. On the eastern side of this platform was a lower terrace, along the edge of which were 10 great stone pilasters ranging from 9 to 14 feet in height and from 2 to 4 feet wide. 9 of them are still standing today. The fortress, which also was built in terraces, was even larger than the temple, measuring 620 feet long, 450 feet wide, and 50 feet high. One of the most striking of the ruins is a great doorway, 18 inches thick, 7 feet high, and 13 feet long, cut out of trachyte, a light-colored volcanic rock. The opening through its center is 4.5 feet high and almost 3 feet in width. Above it, the stone is covered with beautiful carvings that remind me of those I have seen in the ancient temples of Egypt. Some of the figures hold scepters and some have crowns on their heads. They have human bodies, feet, and hands, but often the heads of condors. The central one, in especially high relief, is supposed to have represented Pachacamac, believed by some of the Indians to have been the creator of the universe. This doorway has been broken across the top either by earthquake or lightning. Visitors to Tiahuanaco during the middle of the last century say that it was lying on the ground, but later it was found to be standing upright again, although there is no record of who raised it. Another doorway, not so large, has been carried away from the ruins to a cemetery halfway between here and the village. There are many other enormous stone blocks larger than any I have seen elsewhere in the world outside Cusco or Egypt. I saw one 36 feet long and 7 feet wide, and another 26 feet long, 16 feet wide, and 6 feet thick. Some of the blocks are sandstone and others trachyte, the latter beautifully carved and polished. How they were transported here in the dim prehistoric ages when Tiahuanaco was built probably will always be a matter of conjecture, as today rocks of this size are found only at long distances from here. Among the most remarkable features of the ruins are the stone idols that have been dug out of the ground and stood upright. Some of these idols are of gigantic size. Their bodies are so large around that I cannot encircle them with my two arms, and they are more than 8 feet in height. The faces have thick lips, and the heads are so cut that they would be a delight to our modern cubists. They are all angles, even to the eyes, the noses, and the lips. Their features are now sadly mutilated, however, due in great part to the idols being used as rifle targets by Bolivian youths passing through here. Many of the excavations of Tiahuanaco were made known to the outside world by Ephraim George Squire, who came to Peru more than a half century ago as a special commissioner from the United States, and described these ruins in his book, Incidents of Travel in the Land of the Incas. When I was first in Bolivia, more than 25 years ago, I went over Squire's discoveries with Professor Adolf Bandelier, who was then here for the American Museum of Natural History, and who said that Squire's deductions as to the age of this city were in the main correct. Squire was told by the Indians that there were large vaults beneath the temple and that an underground passage led from here to Cusco. He dug under the foundations but found neither vaults nor passage. More recently, further discoveries were made by Dr. Otto Busstein, the director of the National Museum at La Paz. He unearthed many interesting ruins not far from the temple and others elsewhere on the plain. I have visited the National Museum at La Paz, which now contains many of the objects found at Tiahuanaco. Some of the smaller idols have been taken there, as well as several other stone figures and numerous pieces of pottery. The director of the museum believes that the pottery dates back to 8,000 years ago, or to more than 6,000 years before Christ. If he is correct, these are the oldest records of civilization now in existence. He tells me that he does not think that Tiahuanaco was a city of the red race, but of a white race that inhabited this part of the Andes in prehistoric times. In this idea, he is not alone. Others have expressed the belief that the Bolivian plateau was once inhabited by the ancient Phoenicians, and that the gold of Ophir came from the Andes. The Bible states that the ships were 3 years in making the journey to the mines. In those ancient times, it would certainly have taken as much as 3 years for a ship to pass out of the Mediterranean through the Strait of Gibraltar, cross the Atlantic Ocean to the west coast of this continent by way of the Strait of Magellan, and then return. The verse referred to says they brought back gold and also almug trees and ivory apes and peacocks. There is no ivory in South America, and the peacock comes from India. There are plenty of monkeys in the lowlands of this continent, but as to the almug tree, I know it not. The collection of pottery numbers thousands of pieces and fills several rooms. The objects are of all sizes, from vases that will hold 3 or 4 gallons to little cups not as large as an eggshell. There are bowls and beautifully shaped terracotta cups. Many of the latter are as fine as porcelain, and when tapped give forth a similar sound. Some of the pottery resembles the Etruscan in its decoration, while other pieces are covered with hieroglyphics, somewhat like Chinese or Japanese characters. The cups and the bowls, shaped like a cat, seem to indicate an Egyptian origin. They made me think of Bubastis, where the people worshipped the cat in the days of the pharaohs. The ancient city was situated in the land of Goshen, not far from the present site of Zagazig, and on the main route from the Holy Land to Egypt. Bubastis had many cat goddesses, the greatest of which was a cat-headed woman. It had a cemetery filled with the mummies of cats, many of which had been encased in coverings of wood or bronze. Among the cat-shaped pots of Tiahuanaco were found skeletons of llamas and vases shaped like the head of the condor, the great vulture-like eagle of the Andes. The excavations at Tiahuanaco have also yielded up many implements of stone, gold, copper, and bronze, spoons of terracotta, knives of bone, and arrow points of obsidian, a black, glossy volcanic rock. Bone rings and needles of various kinds have been found, as well as stone pipes drilled out of a rock as hard as quartz. How the people were able to drill the holes without steel or other metal is unknown. All these things were found within 10 feet of the surface of the earth. The soil above them was sand, indicating that the city of Tiahuanaco was for a long time covered with water, which probably accounts for the remarkable state of preservation of the relics. Much of the pottery was found near human skeletons and seemed to have been buried with the dead. There were 2 pots beside the skull of a man or woman and 1 beside that of a child. On the foreheads of the skulls of the women were plates of pure gold as thin as paper. Each plate bears the image of a man, indicating perhaps that the weaker sex worshipped the stronger 8,000 years ago, regardless of how man's acknowledged superiority has since dwindled. The features of the image are beautifully marked and look as though the gold leaf had been pressed upon a die. Although the Aymara Indians about Tiahuanaco are supposed to be descended from a race much older than the Incas, their skulls are not like those found in the excavations. The skulls I saw in the museum are different from any known to anthropologists. Of enormous size, they indicate a race of giants. The forehead slope back from the eyes, reminding one of the Flathead Indians of North America. The jaw bones are heavy, and the teeth are still almost perfect, though perhaps 80 centuries old. The Aymaras have many stories and legends as to their origin. One is that the first people on earth became so wicked that the gods turned them into the stone idols of Tiahuanaco. According to another Aymara tradition, the world was created by the great god Pachacamac, who made it beautiful to look upon and filled it with comforts. It was ruled, however, by Kunu, who brought droughts and cold and pestilences until man could hardly exist and became little more than a beast. Then Pakakamek fought the evil Kunu. He sent rains to make the deserts bloom and brought forth the sun to warm the earth. But Kunu was not yet vanquished. He added to the rains until a flood occurred, during which the earth was in darkness. After that, according to the legend, the prayers of the people were answered by Inti, the sun god, who rose from his shrine in Lake Titicaca to flood the earth with warmth and light. Another god, Tichihuiracocha, aided him by smoothing down the mountains, filling up the valleys with fertile soil, and causing waters to flow from the rocks and irrigate the land. Above all, he instilled in the hearts and minds of the people the qualities of piety, order, and industry. Realizing that gold and silver were the cause of greed and corruption, he hid them in the depths of the most inaccessible regions or in lofty mountains. It was under this god that man was given a fresh start and eventually achieved his present civilization. These Indians of Tiahuanaco hold on feast days a sort of war dance that rivals the ruins as an attraction for most tourists. The men wear costumes of colored cloth and much bright tinsel, with headdresses of brilliant feathers made in great fan shapes. Marching through the town, performing a sort of snake dance, they are accompanied by a bedlam of noise produced by the violent beating of drums and the playing of native flutes. The celebration usually ends in a drunken carousal in which chicha and alcohol flow freely. Similar carnivals, I am told, are held at La Paz. Another exhibit of much interest in the La Paz Museum is a large collection of mummies, discovered near the Arica-La Paz Railway when that line was being built. They are supposed to be the mummies of the Chulpas, who lived before the time of the Incas. Each is enclosed in a basket or bag of fiber, with the head of the mummy protruding from an opening in one end. The material out of which the bag is made is like pineapple fiber, and notwithstanding its great age, it is firm and strong. The threads are evenly twisted, and each bag is woven to the exact size and shape of the mummy within. The Chulpas were buried in a sitting position, the legs so doubled up that the knees were tucked under the chin and the arms clasped back of the neck. I saw scores of these mummies and was allowed to carry some of them outside to be photographed. One was that of a young woman. It was at least 1,500 years old, but the bones were sound and the teeth were as white as snow and in far better condition than my own. I carried her out of the darkness and put her down gently in the sunlight on the steps beside me. As I did so, there came to my mind the soliloquy of the hero in Tennyson's Vision of Sin, as he dances the tango with his skeleton partner. You are bones, and what of that? Every fate, however full, padded round with flesh and fat, is but modeled on a skull. No, I cannot praise the fire in your eye, nor yet your lip. All the more do I admire joints of cunning workmanship. End of chapter 24. Chapter 25 of Lands of the Andes and the Desert by Frank G. Carpenter. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. The Aymara Indians. In coming to northern Bolivia from Peru, I have left the land of the Quichua Indians for that of the Aymaras, who live about Lake Titicaca in the northern part of the Bolivian plateau. They comprise the chief Indian race of this republic, although the Quichuas are found again in the southern part of the country. The Aymaras are said to have been so powerful that they were never subjugated by the Incas, as were the other Indian nations that inhabited the western part of South America. Even after centuries under the white man's rule, they are today more aggressive and independent than the humble and submissive Quichuas. They are also larger in stature than the Peruvian Indians, most of them having an extraordinary chest development that enables them to breathe without difficulty in this rarefied atmosphere. After the Spanish conquest, the Aymaras were practically enslaved, and many of them on the plateau are still in a state of peonage. The Indian of Bolivia is so attached to his bit of land that it has always been almost impossible to make him leave when large tracts have been formed into great estates. Rather than seek a home elsewhere, he prefers to work for the white owner a certain number of days a week in return for the right to stay on. He receives no pay except the privilege of occupying a hut and cultivating a small piece of ground. Indeed, the Aymara cares nothing for his country, his government, his wife or children, and little for his own comfort, but he is genuinely attached to his bit of land and his llamas or sheep. Unless his animals are commandeered by his employer or the government, he refuses to sell them at any price, although he will practically sell his children as servants. An Englishwoman who has been living here for years says that a system of child slavery still exists in both Peru and Bolivia. Indeed, this woman tells me that she herself has bought boys and girls under 12 years of age. At times she has given them a home out of pity, and at other times because she wished to use them as servants. The system is similar to the custom of binding out children to work for their board and clothes that was once common in some parts of the United States. When particularly in need of money, Indian parents offer to sell a child as a servant for from $5 to $10 in gold. A contract is then made in which the parents are given the right to take the child back upon repayment of this sum. But as it is practically an impossibility for the Indian to obtain enough money to do so, the purchase of the child usually means that one has its services until it grows up. The law provides that it must be well treated and taught to read and write. Practically all the domestic labor of La Paz and other cities of Bolivia is done by the Aymaras. The lowest types are the Pongos, who carry burdens, bring the vegetables and meats from the market, and clean the pots and pans. All kinds of drudgery falls to their lot, including much work that servants of other classes refuse to do. Indeed, though the rich man may afford 20 other servants, he must still have his Pongo. Notwithstanding his hard life, the Indian servant is attached to his master and will work for him for little or nothing rather than for a foreigner who will pay good wages. The Aymaras make their master's grievances their own and are ready to fight for them on any occasion. Feuds are often carried on between the Indians of neighboring farms, who engage in pitched battles with guns or with slings, the ancient weapon of the Aymaras. Fights over land are common even among the small property owners. It is not unusual for one man to remove another's boundary marks and then drive in his sheep to graze. This usually precipitates a bloody battle, all the friends of each man being brought in as reinforcements. These Indians do not like strangers, and I found them particularly averse to having me photograph them or their homes. These huts are usually in villages, but some of them stand alone on the plateau and high up on the mountain slopes. The houses and the home life of the Aymaras are much like those of the Quechuas. Often the cooking is done outside, and sometimes an oven is built against the wall with a cover to protect it from the wind and the snow. As in Peru, the women and children may be seen spinning wool as they watch their flocks or drive their llamas along the trails. Even the bags for grain and potatoes are usually of homespun. A favorite dish of the Aymaras is a stew of dried mutton called chalona. To make chalona, the carcass of the sheep is sprinkled with water at night and left out of doors to freeze, the process being repeated several times. It is then hung up to dry and soon becomes so tough and hard that it will keep for months. When used, it is cut into bits and boiled a long time, often with vegetables and chuño. About the same habits of drinking and coca chewing prevail among the Aymaras as among the Quechuas. However, it is said that these Indians are more intelligent than those of Peru, and that the average mentality rises as one goes on southward. When his mind has not been deadened by alcohol or cocaine, the Aymara is like the Japanese in his aptitude for learning new things. It is not uncommon to find boys and girls who are equal to the whites in quickness and mental alertness, and it is known that many of the prominent men of La Paz have a strain of Aymara blood. There is no doubt about the natural mechanical ability of the Aymara. He is painter, carpenter, and mason in La Paz. All the labor on the fine houses and public buildings of the city has been done by him, and he often exhibits considerable artistic ability in making exterior decorations of mica mixed with lime and sand, and then burned in such a way that it has a finish like that of the best plaster of Paris. The Indians make much of the furniture used in La Paz and do a great deal of interior woodwork in mahogany, rosewood, and black walnut. They also operate the machinery in many of the factories and mines of Bolivia. They seem to be industrious, and their employers say that they are as good workers as the Cholos or whites. Many of the best laborers and mechanics of the country are Indians, who, while serving in the army, acquired such a taste for civilization that they have come to the cities to work. When their military service is over, most of them are not content to go back to the semi-savage life of their villages. Those who do go carry with them the seeds of civilization, which soon sprout into a crop of new ideas and customs. The reorganization of the Bolivian army several years ago made military service compulsory for every youth between the ages of 19 and 21. As the army is not large enough to take in every man, however, lots are drawn annually to see who will serve. Thousands of Indians from every part of the republic are brought to the military barracks and schools, where they are drilled by German officers. They make fine-looking soldiers and are said to have good fighting qualities, being particularly noted for their great powers of endurance. In addition to being taught to obey, they learn to read and write and do simple sums. Soldiers are always on guard at the president's palace and the capital, and I frequently see them marching through the streets of La Paz. They serve on the local police force, which is a good one. An institution that is doing much toward the civilization of Bolivia's Indians is the Industrial Mission School that has been founded on the shores of Lake Titicaca. The school is supported by funds donated by an Italian, one Antonio Ciotto, who became an ardent Christian while in Los Angeles. As a young man, he had left Italy and settled in California, where he made money in the milling industry, and then emigrated to Argentina. There he became interested in bettering the condition of the Indians of South America, and when he knew he had not much longer to live, he decided to leave his money to the Argentinians for that purpose. However, the laws of that republic presented certain legal difficulties in the accomplishment of this purpose, and he thereupon came to Bolivia to carry out his scheme. Ciotto's estate, consisting of about $35,000, was used to purchase 500 acres of level land on the shores of Lake Titicaca, about 45 miles from La Paz. There were 250 Indians living on it, who, according to custom, went with the property. They were allowed to retain the little patches of ground that their ancestors cultivated from generation to generation, and given the use of pasture for their flocks of sheep and llamas. In return, they work for the mission about 2 days of each week. The manager of the farm says that at first, the Indians would have nothing to do with the missionaries. They had been told that they would be worked to death and cheated out of all their property. However, once they learned to trust the Americans, a great desire for education sprang up among them, and a school was established and is attended by both children and grown-ups. The children have to work for their parents most of the day, and so their school hours are from 7 to 9 in the morning, but they are so anxious to learn that they usually are on hand before the teachers are awake. New plants and grasses have been introduced at the farm, and experiments are being made with grains to see if better crops cannot be raised on the plateau. The trustees expect to improve the breeds of sheep and to bring in goats and American cattle. The manager says he had great difficulty at first in persuading the Aymaras to try anything new, particularly the modern American plow. They were shown that our plows could go twice as deep as theirs, but they were not entirely converted until they saw that the land plowed in the new way raised better crops than ever before. The manager tells me that many of these Indians still believe in witchcraft, and that although they are supposedly Christians, they reverence spirits and the manifestations of the forces of nature. During the drought, they worship streams and springs, and in cold weather, they pray to the stars and the moon that their crops may not be ruined by frost. They think that death is caused by a spell cast over the deceased. When a man dies, his relatives and friends are anxious that the witches shall not continue to pursue his soul. Not long ago, the family of a man who had just died came to the overseer of the school farm and asked him to make a cross on a piece of paper, and below that to write, I have died because I am bewitched by my enemies, and I here pray to the Lord that I may be free from them in the future." This paper was put into the hands of the dead man and buried with him. Another United States school in Bolivia that has accomplished much for the Indians is the American Institute at La Paz. It is supported largely by the Methodist Episcopal Church, but the Bolivian government considers it of such benefit that it makes an annual appropriation for it and encourages it in every possible way. The school was founded by Methodist missionaries in 1907 at the request of the Bolivian government and is non-sectarian in its teaching. When it was first opened, it had 120 boys in attendance, and since then the number has grown to 300 or more. The buildings of the institute are crowded, and there are more applicants than can be admitted. The boys are of all classes, from the sons of wealthy farmers and miners to those of Indian burden bearers. They may enter the school at any age and stay through the equivalent of a high school course. Many of the graduates become clerks and private secretaries, and others continue their studies in the colleges of law or medicine in one of the Bolivian universities. The students come from all parts of Bolivia and even from Chile and Peru. Not a few of them have to travel a month by mule, stagecoach, and train to reach La Paz. During my stay here, I visited this institute and talked with its teachers, who are graduates of the best universities and colleges in the United States. It is modeled after our boys' boarding schools and has all the features that make school life pleasant. To some extent, it has taken the part of a young men's Christian association in the encouragement of games and the development of athletics. It has a literary society, school publications, and a Boy Scout organization that puts on football matches and track meets. I have before me the program, printed in Spanish, of a recent tournament. The contestants were in three classes, the first of which was for former pupils and students about 15 years of age. The second class included boys between 11 and 15 years, and a third class was for boys under 11. At the end of the meet, prizes of gold, silver, and bronze medals were presented by the United States Minister to Bolivia. The Methodist Church has established also a secondary school at Cochabamba in the heart of Bolivia, about 300 miles from La Paz. That school receives the same support from the government as the one at La Paz. The elementary public schools of Bolivia are managed chiefly by the municipalities. Attendance in them is nominally compulsory, but they have almost no Indian pupils. Last year, these pupils numbered only about 500, with not more than 60,000 students. The Republic has about 40 schools for higher education, including high schools for girls at La Paz, Sucre, Santa Cruz, and Trinidad. There are universities at Sucre and La Paz, and schools of mines at Oruro and Potosi. La Paz has a commercial school with classes for men and women, and also schools of engineering, mining, and agriculture. In the past, Bolivia has relied almost entirely on minerals as the source of its wealth. Now the development of agriculture is receiving more and more attention from the government, and in 1922, a law was passed prohibiting the opening of a public school where there is not enough ground for a school garden. This law provides for an agricultural course in the normal schools that prepare teachers to work among the Indians. The state also gives a certain amount each year for the support of the educational program of the Catholic Church, which has missions throughout eastern Bolivia. End of chapter 25. Chapter 26 of Lands of the Andes and the Desert by Frank G. Carpenter. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. From La Paz to Oruro. I have come from La Paz to Oruro, the center of the greatest tin-producing region in all the Americas. To reach it, I rode for 8 hours across the bare, stony plateau on the La Paz-Antofagasta Railway. We passed many Indian villages and now and then saw scattered homes here and there on the plain. About Lake Titicaca, the huts of the natives were rectangular in shape, but these were round, and many of them had mud instead of thatched roofs. Each farm settlement contained several such homes surrounded by corrals for the cattle. At one station I noticed hundreds of llamas, which had come in loaded with bundles of a kind of evergreen shrub that is used for fuel on the plateau. The bushes are grubbed out from the mountainsides and carried to the stations on the backs of men and women as well as on llamas. Among the picturesque crowds around the stations at two or three of these plateau villages, I caught glimpses of the Calahuaya, or traveling witch doctors of the Andes. A member of this profession is recognized at a glance by his distinctive costume, which consists of black breeches, a red and white poncho, a bright colored sash, and a broad sombrero hat. On his breast he wears a huge silver cross, and slung across one shoulder is a wallet containing aromatic gums, barks, herbs, charms, and figures like the small stone llamas I saw at Cuzco. The Calahuaya travel in groups, often staying away from home for as long as 5 years. They go from place to place, stopping a while in each town, where they serve as a combination of witch doctor, veterinary, lawyer, and general counselor for all who seek their advice. During these ramblings, the women are always left at home. Indeed, it is not unusual for a man about to be gone for a long time to ensure his wife a home by bestowing her upon a bachelor friend. It is also customary for the husband, upon his return, to adopt any children born to his wife during his absence. Farther on, I rode for miles through a flooded region where heavy rains that had fallen the night before had covered the pampa with water. In some places it looked like a great lake. In others the waters had subsided, leaving a sort of alluvial deposit. Parts of the plateau were dry and with almost no vegetation. Other parts were alkaline, and the white sands almost blinded my eyes. The mountains are farther away than on the Peruvian plateau, and although the altitude is almost 2.5 miles, one does not seem to be at such a great elevation. Except for the massive snow-covered top of Illimani, which was within plain sight as I left La Paz, the country as seen from the car windows was bleak and monotonous. Later, I had also a fine view of the extinct volcano of Sahama. An Indian legend says that the mountain was once the summit of the flat-top Mount Chakultaya, and that it was knocked off by a stone from the sling of a giant and hurled to its present location. The stone, the legend says, still exists as a hillock on the plain near the town of Villaca, which we reached about an hour after leaving the Alto above La Paz. Oruro derives its name from the Uru Indians, who lived on the shores of Titicaca when that lake covered the entire region between here and its present shores. It lies on the plateau at an altitude of more than 12,000 feet, and as a whole is windy, dusty, and unattractive. The streets are filled with sand blown about by the sharp winds that sweep over the plateau, and the few trees and shrubs are stunted and dry. Rising behind the city is a background of desert hills honeycombed with mine openings. Many of the houses of Oruro are one-story adobe buildings, but it has some good stores and hotels, and there are movie theater and clubs established by the foreign population. The city now has about 20,000 inhabitants, but is said to have had four times as many in colonial days when silver mining was at its height in the hills about the town. Silver is still mined here, but the chief mineral product of the region is tin. I came to Oruro in a comfortable train, in company with English, Australian, and American commercial travelers, wealthy Bolivians, and miners and tourists from the United States. The trip was far different from the one I made over the same route years ago. That was long before the railway was built, and I rode for 3 days behind mule teams that went at a gallop all the way. A stage then ran twice a week from La Paz to Oruro. The coaches, which were the most dilapidated rattle traps that ever ran upon wheels, had 6 seats inside and one on top with the driver. It was the place on the driver's seat that I coveted, but I found at the stage office that it was already reserved and that the whole inside had been taken by a rich Bolivian and his family. All the space in the next stage 3 days later was also sold out, and for a time it seemed that I should have to go on muleback or hire a private conveyance, which would have cost $150. At that moment, a friend, advisor, and guide in ways Bolivian advised me to try to get a seat on the mail coach. I learned that there was always room for one passenger on it, and that this seat had not been taken, so I lost no time in handing out the $20 for my fare. All baggage had to be ready by noon of the day before we started. It took three Indians to carry mine to the station, and La Paz gazed in wonder as the men trotted through the streets with their loads. At the stage office, a second dilemma arose. Only 200 pounds of luggage were allowed. If a passenger had more, it was supposed to follow him on the next stage, although the chances were that it would be forgotten for weeks. My trunks tipped the beam of the American scales on which they were weighed at just 370 pounds, and it took much persuasion, monetary as well as verbal, before the officials consented to let me take the entire amount with me. At last I was told that it could be done, and was handed a bill for extra charges that amounted to a sum greater than my fare. I am not more than ordinarily conceited, but I must confess that I felt rather proud that not only myself, but my baggage as well, were to be carried over the country with the Bolivian government mails. I had visions of a gorgeous red Concorde vehicle with uniformed postmen, and it was with conscious pride that I told my friends at La Paz how I was going to travel. I noticed that some of them smiled, and that others looked at me more in pity than in admiration. At the time, I attributed this to jealousy, envy, or ignorance. Soon enough, I thought differently. I had my first sight of the mail coach at 6 o'clock on the morning of my departure. It was a mere baggage wagon, and the only seat on it was the one with the driver. The bed of the vehicle was so far up in the air that I could almost walk under it without stooping. The wagon box was not more than 6 inches deep, and I could not see how a ton and a half of bale and trunks could be put into it. I had my baggage hurried out, and it went in at the bottom. The other pieces were piled on top until the wagon looked more like a load of hay coming to the barn in harvest time than the government mail. A rawhide rope was bound round and round the hole, which was then covered with canvas to protect it from a possible rainstorm. By this time, the mules were in their places, and I was told to climb to my seat beside the driver. It was at least 7 or 8 feet above the ground, and without a sign of a cushion of any kind. I finally improvised some with my blankets, and was not uncomfortable. My chief grievance was the lack of cover-up when it rained and snowed, as it did several times during the trip. My only protection then was my waterproof and my knitted hood. The liveried coachmen of my imagination were cholos. They had no consideration whatever for the mules, and their treatment of them was so cruel that I several times protested, useless though it was. In the first place, the harness was twisted until there was not a tug that was straight and not a collar that fitted. As a result, the necks of the animals were raw and sore, and this condition became worse as we went on the gallop over the road. I remember one little yellow mule that even before he was put into harness had lost 2 patches of skin, each as big as the palm of my hand from the front of his shoulders. I objected to taking him, as there were older and better mules in the corral, but he was hitched up nevertheless and was given one of the hardest places in the team. This was next to the wagon and directly under the driver. We started off at a gallop, but the little beast soon slackened his pace. Then the torture began. The driver cut at him with a whip that drew blood everywhere it touched. We had not gone 5 miles before the mule's back was bleeding in a half dozen different spots, and I could see that his collar was red with blood from the raw places on his neck. From time to time I noticed that the driver, when he found that his whipping and whistling failed to hurry the mules, took a heavy tug with an iron chain and ring at one end and rattled it. This rarely failed to frighten the animals into increased speed, but if they did not respond, the driver swung it about his head and brought it down with a terrible thud upon the little mule's back. We changed animals every 15 or 20 miles, and there was hardly a team that was not scarred and bloody in a short time. During the trip, I had plenty of opportunity to learn what the country hotels of Bolivia were like in those days. The stations where we stopped to eat and sleep were more like stables than inns. None of the rooms had windows, and the floors were of mud or stone. In some, the beds were ledges of sun-dried bricks upon which a mattress had been laid. The only light I had was the candle I brought with me, and my candle holder was a spot of melted grease that I dropped on the table or a chair before setting the candle down. There were always several beds in a room, and I had natives for roommates every night. Before I retired, the hotel keeper would come in and collect a dollar for the use of the bed and a dollar for dinner. We started at 5 every morning, and at 4:30 I was up and ready for a cup of tea, which, with a couple of biscuits, comprised the breakfast served in such places. Lunch, which was our real breakfast, was eaten at 11 or 12 o'clock and was more like a dinner. It began with a vegetable soup and was followed by two or three stewed dishes, all of which fairly swam in grease. Dinner was much the same. Such were the accommodations on one of the most traveled roads of the country. Conditions of the mule trails were far worse. Prospectors, when off the beaten tracks, frequently were unable to procure food or shelter of any kind. This condition exists even today in parts of interior Bolivia, as many of the Indians will not allow strangers to come into their huts if they can possibly prevent it. Money seems to be no inducement to them, and the only way to get a night's shelter in such cases is to go in and take possession of the best part of the hut. If there is anything at hand that is eatable, take it and give the Indian some money for it. If you ask to buy it, he will refuse, and even if he has plenty, he will say he has nothing. The chances are that next morning, when you pay him for your night's lodging, he will not be displeased, but he will offer you nothing and will sell as little as he can. 25 years ago, there were almost no good roads in Bolivia. The highways through the mountains were nothing but mule trails, often cut along the sides of precipices so that one road within an inch or so of destruction. Indeed, the road over which I traveled was then the best one in Bolivia. The dried-up basin of the great inland sea that once covered the plateau formed a natural roadbed. In some places it was as flat as a floor for miles, and in others there was a gradual slope, but not enough to impede the galloping of the mules. We went through long stretches of land where there were great piles of stones scattered over the fields, and in several places I saw Indian women going along picking up stones and carrying them in the front of their skirts. They are used also to make walls between the fields, and there are so many of them that the walls and the piles usually cover as much ground as the cleared area. The La Paz-Oruro Road was one of the few routes on which freight was transported by wagon. On most trails, it was carried on the Andean beasts of burden or on the backs of men and women. We met no other vehicles on the road, although we passed droves of animals loaded with all kinds of freight. There were scores of donkeys carrying bundles of coca leaves on their backs to supply the towns farther south. Llamas loaded with silver ore stalked proudly along with cocked ears, and there were many trains of mules. Each train was managed by one or two Indians who walked with or behind the animals, never riding them so far as I could see. All the prospectors used mules for traveling over the country, and all supplies for the mines had to be carried through the mountains in that way. Before the railways were built, mining machinery to be used in Bolivia had to be made in sections, no piece of which could be larger or heavier than a mule could carry on its back. End of chapter 26.